Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It on WNYC. Welcome, everyone. I'm Shamita Basu. I'm a reporter in the WNYC newsroom. I'm just sitting in for Allison Stewart. We're beginning today's show with a conversation about millennials. Do you find yourself unable to get through your ever-expanding list of errands, from getting a pair of pants hemmed to answering emails that have been piling up in your inbox? Let me say it this way. Are you successful at work, but paralyzed by the mere thought of finding a dentist in your network? If so, according to BuzzFeed reporter Ann Helen Peterson, you might be suffering from millennial burnout. Now, before you roll your eyes and change the dial, because you think this is going to be another run-of-the-mill, why can't millennials seem to do anything well kind of conversation, I urge you to stick with us, because my guest has written a really thoughtful reflection on how this generation has been vilified, incentivized, and ultimately paralyzed. Ann Helen Peterson is a reporter for BuzzFeed, and she joins me now. Hi, Ann. Welcome to All of It.
Oh, I'm so happy to be here.
I'm so happy you're here. Your article is called How Millennials Became the Burnout Generation, and it's been making the rounds on social media. There have been a lot of reflective responses, too. But in your article, you sort of dispel the myth that millennials are too lazy or too entitled or coddled or whatever to handle the simple acts of adulting, like going to the post office. In fact, you argue that millennials are working harder than any generation before, but we're just getting less results. So tell me how you got to the term millennial burnout and how you're applying it here.
So I found myself unable to do a lot of the things that you listed at the top of the hour. So like my specific ones were taking the knives to the cobbler, responding to an email from like a close friend who I love, you know, I want to respond to her, taking my picking up dry cleaning, very simple things that actually didn't have a whole lot of payoff, right? So they were the things that I think of on the bottom half of my to-do list.
The not fun now, part of your to-do list.
Yes. Yeah. And to be clear, I was doing all of the things I needed to be doing at work. You know, this is something that I think oftentimes has gotten mixed up is like somehow I was being lazy. Like I was doing all of these other things. It's just I couldn't bring myself to do those other tasks. And I didn't understand it. I said, you know, I am a type A person who can like kill a to-do list. Mm-hmm. So what is going on? And this was after the election. I had been reporting on the election leading up to it. And so I thought to myself, like, how can I investigate this? Who can I talk to? And I started doing a lot of reading about labor and millennials' relationship to labor.
As
and
one does, just... while your to-do list piled up, I'm sure.
Yes. Right. But then it dawned on me. I was like, oh, this is burnout. And the reason I didn't recognize it as such, even though my editor had said to me, you know, I think you might be burnt out. And I was like, no, I'm doing great. Like, I was working, right? The problem was that I was conceiving of burnout as something that you kind of come down with like it's the cold or the flu or something, right? And then you have a restorative weekend. You do some self-care. You know, I got a massage and I got a facial. Mm-hmm. But I didn't that's not what burnout is.
Burnout is not a passing state, you're saying.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And instead, it became clear to me that burnout had been my base condition for probably the last 8 to 10 years. And as I read more and talked to more people, like it seemed clear that this wasn't just something that was afflicting me, but had really become the baseline condition for many people in my generation.
Yeah. So why do you define it as a millennial condition? Or is it just that it sounds like this could apply to anyone who's juggling work and a home-related to-do list?
I think a lot of the things that I talk about that have consolidated on the millennial generation, so things like student debt, job precarity, difficulty with insurance or steady insurance, entering the workforce during the financial crisis and not reaching job stability for up to a decade. So basically not entering adulthood until well into your 30s in terms of financial stability, if any at all. Social media, all of these different things, right? Mm-hmm. They accumulate on our generation in a more acute way than the ones preceding us. Now, Gen Z, who knows what's going to happen, right? Like they have not yet reached adulthood per se. But I think even though generations are absolutely smudgy. Like, there are people, you know, if you were born in 1980, that doesn't mean that you are walled off from the conditions of millennialism. But at the same time, I think that the idea of generations are useful just in terms of trying to delineate who has been facing all of these things at the same time during their peak adult years.
Listeners, my guest is BuzzFeed's Anne Helen Peterson. Her article is called How Millennials Became the Burnout Generation. And we are taking your calls on this. Millennials or not, call in if you'd like to talk about your experience with burnout. 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. And if you read the article, tell us what did and maybe didn't ring true for you in the piece. You can also tweet at @allofitwnyc. One more time, the number, 212-433-9692. Now, Anne, your article sort of reminded me of this New York Magazine article that came out just before the midterm elections. And it was about why some people aren't planning to vote. And there was this one person who was a millennial who said they didn't register because mailing stuff and dealing with the post office gives them anxiety. And I just remember this article became such a lightning rod. People who are critical of millennials kind of piled on and said, look at this example, the overcoddled generation who can't handle something simple like going to the post office. And I know a lot of millennials kind of cringed at reading it. Like, this is one of our own who's saying, admitting this out loud. But what you're saying sort of justifies the feeling that this person described, right?
Well, and I think everyone's, like, the bottom half of their to-do list is different. So for me, you know, I had moved to Montana. I needed to register to vote. It actually was a somewhat complicated process, but not nearly as complicated as registering to vote in the place where this person was, which is Texas. Mm-hmm. You know, there are a lot of things about contemporary society that are purposefully meant to prevent us from doing them, right? Like, a lot of voter registration in many states is meant to discourage people from registering to vote. Same thing with filing insurance reimbursements. We, you know, the less we do it, the more money the insurance companies make. So there is a reason why these processes are so convoluted. They are meant to, you know, intersect with our burnout, right, and our inability to do things.
The hurdle is purposefully high, you're saying there.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so, like, there are two ways that I saw people react to that article. One was like, and I said this too, I was like, get your crap together, like, mm-hmm, go to the post office, right? But at the same time, other people were pointing out, here are the you know, the ways that people, that voting has been disincentivized across the United States. And we should think seriously about the roadblocks that have been put in place to discourage people to vote.
Right.
And so I think, you know, anything that we are doing, one of the things I quote in the article is that if you think someone is lazy, it's because you are missing part of their context. Mm. You know, there is a reason why they are behaving the way that they are. And even with, like, laziness that we think of, like, oh, he only lays on the couch all day and plays video games. So why is that person laying on the couch and playing video games? Something is going on. And so if we can try to be more empathetic towards each other's contexts, and that means everything from mental health to, you know, what it's like to be someone with, you know, a black or brown body moving through the world, not, you know, having white privilege or straight privilege or all these different things. What's key is trying to think outside of our own context and trying to understand others.
Mm, that's right. Well, speaking of context, you actually don't really mention capitalism too much in this essay, but it sort of seems to be a subject you're skirting around, and you do address it in small ways. But this is the context of how we're living. We're living in a capitalist system. How do you see that contributing to specifically millennial burnout?
Oh, capitalism's all over the place. You know, some people said to me, why didn't you use the term neoliberalism to describe all of these characteristics that we're living under? And, you know, I'm an academic. I have a PhD. I know what neoliberalism is. But the problem with a lot of academic thinking is oftentimes you use these words like neoliberalism, or you use a phrase like, we must overthrow the capital, like, we must overthrow capitalism, or like, the only solution is Marxism. And that alienates an incredibly broad swath of readers. Right. So what if I just show what neoliberalism is instead of using the word? Does it have the same effect? I think so. And I think that most people, many people who have read the article, see that capitalism and the way that our current American version of capitalism is at work, Like they understand that. Like we need to change our relationship to labor. Mm-hmm. And then there are people who said to me, this was a really good article until I got to the part where you said, you know, until we overthrow capitalism. And then I stopped reading. So you can see that even then I lost readers by even just mentioning the word capitalism.
Let's take a call. We have Caitlin in Morganville, New Jersey. Hi, Caitlin. You're on WNYC.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Of course.
This, as a 26-year-old, like, affects me every day. I think about this every day and how much I'm struggling. I moved to California when I graduated college, and instead of being able to get a career and get my, you know, the ground under my feet, I had to work three jobs just to be able to pay rent and a car payment. Mm-hmm. When I ended up moving to New Jersey, I just couldn't handle it from California anymore. I just couldn't work three jobs and try to take care of myself like an adult should be able to. And now I'm stuck in New Jersey taking care of my grandmother, and I still feel like I'm just never going to be able to make it. I decided to go back to school and get my master's degree, and now I'm $77,000 in debt, no health insurance, and still in the same boat. It's like I feel like I'm just never, ever going to be able to take care of myself the way I should.
Caitlin, I hear you. Thank you for calling in. Anne, what do you think of Caitlin's story? She says she has three jobs. I know that you mentioned this idea of the gig economy right now, too, and how this is affecting millennials in the workforce. Tell us what your thoughts are on people in her situation.
Oh, man, I relate to Caitlin so hard. Like that idea that, oh, I couldn't get a job out of college, right? I couldn't either, a good job. And the solution that we were told was go back to school. Right? Like, wait out the recession. And a lot of us did that. And a lot of us took on a whole lot of debt, including myself. And the thing is that it's not like you graduate with a master's degree or a PhD in my case, and that there's suddenly a job for you. Instead, there's your student debt and there's trying to find a job all over again. And in some ways, it's oftentimes a little harder because you are overqualified for positions. And I think that, you know, what Caitlin's talking about, too, just in terms of being a caregiver, like there is a lot of burnout there, too, because there's no time off from being a caregiver or very little time off. And it's a different sort of vigilance that's required of you and an emotional labor. And just that idea, like, when am I ever going to get that security to move forward? You know, someone was saying earlier, a critique was like, oh, well, we have better job prospects and lower unemployment than ever before, but we rarely talk about the quality of those jobs. So, like, Caitlin was someone who is employed with three jobs. Retail workers are employed, but oftentimes, you know, don't have their schedule until the week of their work. So how hard is it to schedule childcare on top of that, especially when you've moved somewhere to find a job, and that's often away from friends or family or a support group that can you know, make it easier for you to juggle all of your responsibilities.
You know, one thing I really admire about you, Anne, is that you have welcomed other perspectives on what you write about, and you acknowledge that yours cannot possibly be the only perspective. You know, your piece, and you've acknowledged this, is really centered on a suburban white millennial woman's experience of burnout, which is why in the past 10 days or so, you've been sharing some reactions to the piece, people explaining their experience of millennial burnout as a Black woman, as a child of immigrants, as a member of a religious community. So I want to know what you've been absorbing about how race and class factor into this conversation about burnout.
Well, I've had a pretty like classic white privilege moment where, you know, something that I thought of as novel in terms of like, oh, I have burnout, you know, is actually something that a lot of people have been dealing with, not just for, you know, several years, but for generations. Mm. And so for me, it's been a time of really trying to listen and internalize the ways in which like my novel white experience is not novel at all. And if anything, you know, a lot of the conversations about millennials have to this point really centered on the white bourgeois experience. And, you know, the success of my article in a lot of ways continues to center that experience. So my work now, how can I decenter that? How can I continue the conversation in a way that continues to decenter it? Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, a lot in follow-up pieces, in conversations that people have had on Twitter, like that work has been happening, and I'm so grateful for it.
Let's take another call. Hannah in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with these two millennials.
Hi.
Hey, Hannah.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Of course.
So I just want to thank you for writing that article. It really, really spoke to me. It just made me, understand and feel, basically what the part that got that I reflected on the most was the fact that we as millennials have been primed since day one to be the most efficient workers. You talked a lot about that and how at the end of the day, it doesn't really end up working out for a lot of us. And I have a lot of friends who graduated with, you know, degrees from these amazing schools and didn't get a job and then were completely lost, went into depression, just a lot of issues that stemmed from basically trying and working so hard, but not really, you know, getting the benefits from it.
Hannah, thank you for your comments. And I hear what you're saying, which is that we're all just sort of spinning our wheels here. And Anne, you mentioned in your piece, it sort of feels like a whole industry has been created to solve this problem that you've named millennial burnout, which is the self-care industry. You know, buy this face mask, book this massage, use this bath bomb, treat yourself, but only in the most fleeting and financial of ways. So, Anne, what are your thoughts on self-care? Is it a meaningful response to burnout?
Well, I think there's two types of self-care, and some of it is that more kind of tactile, like massages or health, you know, facial masks and that sort of thing, which is pretty fleeting. You know, it doesn't actually solve the overarching problem. It's a moment of focusing on the self. But oftentimes, especially when we're talking about serums, which have become incredibly popular basically in the last 2 years, it's optimizing my face to make me a more presentable and more feminine and less acne-prone person, right?
I like that. That's really good marketing language, too. Optimize your face. That sells.
And also, now that because I started using some serums and now I have less acne, I'm like, well, how can I further optimize my face? So it never stops. And it also is expensive, right? Like it actually requires capital to get a massage.
Yes.
Or to buy expensive facial care. And there are also things like getting a therapist, right? Which is very expensive, especially in New York City, and oftentimes requires insurance that covers it or that covers part of it. People in rural places, like this is something oftentimes that is inconceivable if you live in an urban place like New York. You know, my mom lives in a town of 30,000 in Idaho. There's one therapist. She's okay. And she can get into her once a month, maybe, right? And so it's not something that is even available to a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my favorite comments to the piece was, you know, there's apparently a phrase that's common amongst Spanish therapists, so people from Spain, that, you know, do you need a therapist or do you need a labor union? And so that to me points out, like, do you need that personal self-care or do you need actual better working conditions?
Wow.
Do you need to change your relationship with work? And that points out the crux of the problem.
That's a good one.
I know, right? I'm going to never forget that particular phrase.
And let's take another call. This is Alan in Brooklyn. Alan, you're on WNYC, and you are a parent to millennials, right?
To one, but I'm not observing this about him particularly. It's more general observation about the generation. I've just pulled to the side here. It seems that being raised in the digital age, there are fewer opportunities for kids to get involved with hands-on relationships, with materials, with tools like old-fashioned paper and wood and metal crafts and model airplanes and motorized race cars and things that 50 years ago involved more experience with doing things in the physical world. And now so much more of the communication and hobbyism involves manipulating things on a screen in the digital world.
Mm-hmm.
So any chores that involve making that shift from the digital to the physical probably involves a kind of an onerous or distracting step in what would ordinarily be a kind of a smooth, frictionless digital process. So I get the feeling that the reliance on Amazon for delivery instead of shopping or takeout meals instead of cooking, and texting instead of speaking to people and creating physical relationships in the world may all be byproducts of the digital age.
So, Al, it sounds like you're saying maybe some of this burnout is related to taking the humanity out of certain interactions in our day, even our hobbies. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I don't know if I'd really call it burnout by that, because that suggests that the effect is a result of accumulated wear and tear of the process in your life. This has more to do with the way people are initializing their existences as children and entering the world in a way that de-emphasizes the physical and emphasizes the digital.
Anne, do you have thoughts on what Alan is saying?
Yeah, that's something I've thought a lot about. And one of the ways in which many people in our generation have been raised, there's a shift from unstructured play, which is, you know, the good old-fashioned, like, my mom pushed me out the door and said, come back when
the street lights turn
on
or something.
Come on.
Yeah, I knew that one.
To a much more, whether you call it helicopter parenting or vigilante parenting, much more structured parenting style. And that can take the form of everything from supervised play dates to year-round sports and leagues and that sort of thing. Like, I played a lot of kick the can in our neighborhood and like played cards all the time and collected baseball cards. I played marbles. Like, sometimes I think I grew up in the Depression, like the extent of like the physical activity that I did. And there was very little in terms of structured sports. And that has changed so much, even over the course of, you know, I'm an old millennial, so I was born in 1981. So over the course of the 10, 15 years that followed, that seems quaint and rural and something that people do, you know, you have to be very purposeful to have your kids experience that sort of world, whereas it was the opposite. That was the de facto. That was just like how kids were in the world when I was very young. And I think, you know, there's a rise of books and websites and strategies, like whether it's knitting or getting into woodworking. There was a book a couple years ago called Shop Class as Soul Craft. Right? That, like, if you can learn how to manipulate things with your hands, like, it's a way to really work on your soul. And I think what books like that and the rise of other hobbies, analog hobbies, non-digital hobbies, it's pointing to this desire for work that is extremely different from the digital world. You know, is it not playing solitaire on your phone, but actually playing solitaire with a deck of cards even. Or yesterday I was caulking my tub, which is a horrible experience, but it was also very immersive. Like, it was a way to spend my afternoon that felt, you know, it wasn't like catharsis or something, but it was away from all screens and I felt very much in my own head, which I love. Like, I love just hanging out with my own thoughts.
You know, we just got a tweet from someone named JB on Twitter. It says, listening to WNYC about millennial burnout, and wow, I just feel stressed. So JB, maybe try go caulk your tub or something later today. Just step away from everything. Anne Helen Peterson, thank you so much for being here. You can read Anne's piece, How Millennials Became the Burnout Generation, on BuzzFeedNews.com. Anne, thanks for joining us on All of It.
Thank you so much.
And coming up next, the phone lines are going to stay open. We're taking your calls. We want to know what your favorite thing and your least favorite thing is that you see on your commute. So give us a ring. The number is 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. This is All of It. Stay with us. Welcome back to All of It. I'm Shamita Basu, filling in for Allison Stewart. I'm a reporter here in the WNYC newsroom, and I've recently been given a new beat, a new topic to cover, transportation. Of course, with the L train shutdown plans thrown into the air and all of these new questions raised about who really does run the show when it comes to spending and assigning our infrastructure dollars, I think it's a pretty interesting time to be thinking about transportation in our area. But I'm mostly going to be focusing on the commuter experience and what it's like trying to get from point A to point B in and around our city. So we're going to keep our phone lines open for the next 10 minutes or so. And we're going to play a little lightning round style game. I'm calling it favorite, least favorite. Call in and tell us what mode of transit you use for your commute, whether it's subways, buses, carpool, anything. Then tell us your favorite thing and your least favorite thing that you see on your commute. The number, 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. Or you can tweet at allofitwnyc. And listen, I don't want you to overthink this one, friends, okay? I'm going to go first just to give you an example and to do a little tap dancing while people are calling in. I commute by subway. I take the D line mostly. And my least favorite thing to see is someone waking up a sleeping person. A lot of the time I see someone waking a person up who appears to be homeless, usually to get them to stop spreading across several seats. I've seen New York City police officers get onto a subway car at a station just to wake a person up and tell them they can only take up one seat and then get off the subway car. It's usually not an offer to help. It just feels like such a basic act of humanity to let a person sleep undisturbed. So I really dislike that whenever I see that on my commute. Now, one of my favorite things while I'm commuting is eavesdropping on conversations between young children. Now, if you've ever caught a little snippet of something little kids are saying to each other in passing, it is such a delight. The other day, my train was going over the Manhattan Bridge, as it does every single day. It was probably about 4:30 in the afternoon, and I was heading home. I was kind of tired. I was probably looking at my phone, to be honest. And these two boys, they must have been 6 or 7 years old, were turned around in their seats and looking out the windows, getting their smudgy fingers and noses all over the glass and just going, whoa, this is so cool. Where's Chinatown? Oh, I think it's over there. And you know, they were right. It is a really cool view from the Manhattan Bridge, especially when you catch it at the right time and the sun's going down on the East River. So it was a nice reminder that there are some cool things about our commute every day if we just remember to see them that way. So call in. Tell us, you need two when you call it. You need to tell us your favorite and your least favorite things about your commute. Don't overthink it. The number is 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. Or you can tweet at allofitwnyc. And we have some calls on the line already. We have Chris in Oxford, Connecticut. Hi, Chris. You're on WNYC.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Of course.
So I'm calling on behalf of my wife. I guess her favorite and least favorite thing is going to work. She commutes down 84 towards Danbury.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in the car with her one time, and we're passing an exit. And she said, oh, there are my vultures. And sure enough, there's about a dozen vultures. And apparently they hang out near this exit all the time. And my wife really loves seeing them.
So it's just the regular vultures who hang out at that stop.
Yeah.
That's really funny.
And I guess her least favorite thing would be having to go in at 4:30 in the morning, which kind of sucks.
Oh, that's brutal. I've done that one before. Tell your wife I commiserate. Thank you, Chris, for calling in. Let's take another call. Sam in Queens. Tell us your favorite, least favorite.
Hey, hi. Okay, so I take the subway, and everyone's on their phones, but there are the few who actually read while they are on their way to work or mm-hmm. coming from work. And I guess I love seeing which books people are reading right now, but also even more seeing if people just want to be seen reading, you know?
Yes. Yeah. So have you seen anyone reading a book lately that you just made you think, wow, you're reading this book on the subway?
Yeah. Well, every time I see someone reading Infinite Jest, I always go, come on.
Oh, that's great.
It's the biggest, it's the heaviest book. And there's a guy who was like 30 pages from it. And I was like, you're not fooling anybody.
You're just showing off at that point, huh?
But then I also see people who have books and they also have their phones tucked in between the book.
So they're trying to fake
like
other people out?
Wait, say it again?
They're trying to fake other people out, make it look like they're an intellectual who's reading a hard copy?
I think they got one page in, they got like 30 seconds into the page, and then they were like, they got a notification on their phone, took it out, and now they're on Instagram.
The curse of Signal Underground now. Sam in Queens, thank you so much for calling in. Let's take
thank
another
you.
Call. Kay is in Brooklyn. Hi, Kay. You're on WNYC.
Hello. Yes, Brooklyn. Least favorite, definitely easy. Uber drivers. I've been here long enough to remember how to drive pre-Uber. And so everything that used to take me 10 minutes now takes me 25 because I'm fighting 8,550,000 Uber drivers, all kind of distracted by trying to pick somebody up. So that's really
that's your least favorite. I hear you. Do you have a favorite for us?
Absolutely. Either the Whitestone Bridge or the Brooklyn Bridge, or really when you drive over those and you get the perspective on the city. I just fall in love with the city every time again and remind myself why I live here, even with Uber drivers.
That's so lovely. I hope views like that keep you going, even when you have moments of frustration in traffic.
Yeah, no worries.
Okay, thanks a lot for calling in. Joe in New York City. Joe, you have a favorite, least favorite for us?
Hi. Yeah, so my least favorite thing is seeing people picking on their nose and then just touching everything.
Oh, man. Yeah, I can relate to that. That is also a least favorite for me. Do you have a favorite?
So I wake up early. I have a security job over at Lincoln Towers.
Mm-hmm.
And I just for once wish that when I wake up early and go, I'm able to get in the train. So I don't have a favorite thing. It seems like it's always packed and I'm not able to get in, even though I wake up super early.
Oh, no. So your favorite thing has become less and less frequent. Is that what you're saying? Being able to fit into a train?
Yes.
I hope tomorrow is one of those rare days, Joe. I'm pulling for you. Thanks for calling in.
Thank you.
Jillian on Long Island. Hey, Jillian, what's your favorite and least favorite?
Hi. So my least favorite has to be when I'm taking the Long Island Railroad and when people, usually the police tend to, if someone's sitting in the waiting room for, you know, longer than usual, typical, that's sort of subjective time, they'll kick them out. Someone who's, you know, trying to not be in the cold, similar to what you were saying, just frustrating seeing people getting kicked out into the, you know, the bitter January air when there's really no reason for them to be and we're all just sitting in the waiting room together.
Sure, sure. And do you have a favorite thing that brightens your day after you see something like that?
Yeah, when I get into the subway and there's the poems on the walls of the subways, I love those. I mean, there's usually someone sitting right below it, so if you're not staring directly above them, they'll think that you're looking at them. But those poems really brighten my day.
Oh, that's so nice to hear. And you're not the first person to say that. So these subway poems really do have an effect on whether you're having a better commute or not.
Oh, definitely. Great marketing campaign.
Oh, that's great to know. All right, Jillian, thank you for calling in. We have Parker on the line in Greenpoint, Brooklyn. Hi, Parker.
Hi. Leon, I love your show.
Oh, thank you so much. And thanks for calling. Do you have a favorite, least favorite you want to play?
Yes, I do. So my favorite and least favorite thing is the same, just from different perspectives. I love, I take the train to work every day, so mm-hmm. I love seeing people run to catch it because the trains are long, so they have to run from the platform to catch it before the next one comes in 8 minutes. But I hate being that person and sprinting to make it onto the one train, and I frequently miss it.
So this thing is your favorite, least favorite, depending on what side of the closing doors you're on. If you're on the train, it's not fun to watch people running to catch it, or it's fun to watch people, rather, running to catch it. And if you are one of those people, it's not fun.
Right, correct.
Parker, thanks a lot for calling. Hope you catch your G train tomorrow. Jordan in Ridgewood, Queens. Hi, Jordan. You're on WNYC.
Hi. I commute on the L train from Queens to Chelsea, and my favorite thing is after work, every shift, heading back to the subway on 14th Street, I stop at the same bodega, and the workers there all know my name and just make me feel like a beloved regular.
Oh, where everybody knows your name, your corner bodega, of course. So, Jordan, tell me what's your least favorite.
I got to tell you, my least favorite thing is also involves a subway commute. It's seeing mentally ill people confused or worse or homeless on the subway.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Jordan, have you ever attempted to do something when you see someone who appears to be emotionally unstable?
I definitely have. Once at the DeKalb stop on the L, I got out there and I saw what was definitely a mentally ill woman just in panties eating lunch out of a to-go container. And I called 911 right away and to get her help. And it was surprisingly difficult because 911, when you make a call like that, has to transfer you to EMS.
Mm-hmm.
And then EMS asks you all the same information over again. And it's redundant and too long of a phone call.
Yeah, Jordan, I hear you. I think this is something that a lot of people in our city struggle to figure out, really, how to, you know, what's the right way to address these situations and how you can be more helpful than harmful in those cases. So, Jordan, thanks for calling in.
You're welcome.
Maria in Verona, New Jersey. Hi, Maria. You're on WNYC.
Hi, Shamita. You're doing a great job today.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you so much.
So I live in Verona, New Jersey, and I commute west, so not into the city, and I drive. So my
the reverse
least favorite,
commute.
Yes.
I might say.
My least favorite site is I'm taking Route 80 in New Jersey, and I have to get onto another major highway, 287. And my least favorite site is those brake lights from all the traffic that is backed up at that interchange. It's awful. I hate it.
My heart dropped with you just saying it.
Yeah.
Yes.
I look for it every day, and I think, oh, it's going to be a good commute or a bad commute, depending on how far the lights go. And then my favorite site is once I get off of the big highway, I get onto a smaller local road, Route 24, and as I'm traveling along, I pass this meadow or field, and the grasses in the field are this beautiful tawny color, and it's open, and it's so pretty to see, and it reminds me that there is, in fact, still open space left in New Jersey.
Oh,
so I love it.
That's so lovely. Maria, thank you for calling in.
Sure. Thank you. Bye-bye.
We're getting tweets as well. Richard on Twitter says, my favorite thing in the subway is the diversity that we see, the way that all of these different cultures and races can coexist together peacefully. My least favorite thing is people eating on the subway or listening to music so loudly that I can't do my own thing. Yep. Hard relate, Richard. We have one last call, and then I think we're going to need to move on. So, Michael in New York City, you're going to have the last word. Michael, what's your favorite thing about your commute?
Hey, if this is Michael, it's actually New City up in Rockland County.
Oh, forgive me. New City.
No problem. So I drive to work every day, reverse commute, and I get to sit in my car in solitude. So I like that. But my favorite part of that is that I always get NYC in the morning when I commute and in the evening when I go home, and I really do look forward to it. So I'm always hoping that nobody calls me or anything like that so I can get my morning and evening fixes.
Oh, Michael, that's so nice. I wish we could say you win a tote bag
that,
but we can't.
Okay.
I'm kidding. So tell us your least favorite thing.
Oh, my least favorite is the fact that I leave in the dark, at least in the winter months, I leave in the dark and I come home in the dark. And that just, it's really depressing.
Oh, yeah, I know. It's the worst thing. And that happens, is it just part of the year that you're stuck in the dark? Or is there a time of year where...
It's just part of the year. I'm usually home. I usually leave around 6:45 in the morning and I'm usually home, you know, 6:37 at night. I mean, it's a long day, but but coming home in the summer, my kids are always outside playing. I have, you know, a little bit of property, a little front yard, backyard, and I have kids that are always outside playing. So I really enjoy coming home in the summer.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, Michael, the days are getting longer. Thank you for calling in. Yeah. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
And thanks to all of our listeners and everyone who's been tweeting. We still have a bunch of calls on the line, but we're going to have to keep moving. Thank you for your anecdotes. Thanks for being game to play. When we come back, New Yorker contributor Jake Halpern will be in the studio to talk about his recent piece in the magazine, which is called The French Burglar Who Pulled Off His Generation's Biggest Art Heist. Jake is going to tell us all about the climber come thief, whom the French call Spider-Man. More after a quick break. This is All of It. You're listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Shamita Basu, sitting in for Allison Stewart. New York has been home to a lot of different Spider-Men. That is the idea behind last month's Spider-Man movie, after all. A whole universe full of variations on the friendly neighborhood superhero. But here's one version that the five boroughs have not seen. A spider art thief. Actually, the city of Paris gets to claim that version of Spider-Man, but unlike the comic books and movies, the one in France is not fictional. In 2017, Vieren Tomic was sentenced to 8 years in prison for stealing a Picasso, a Matisse, and three other masterpieces from the Paris Museum of Modern Art. He'd committed the crime with such stealth, which earned him the nickname Spider-Man from Parisians, 7 years earlier. In the latest issue of The New Yorker, contributing writer Jake Halpern tells the story of Tomic's heist and sheds a sliver of light on why he might have done it. Jake joins us now via Skype. Hi, Jake.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Of course. So the title of your piece is The French Burglar Who Pulled Off His Generation's Biggest Art Heist. What made it the biggest art heist we've seen in our time?
Well, the five paintings that he stole were estimated to be worth about $70 million. So just on the kind of financials, it put it the biggest heist other than the Gardner heist, which was about 25 years ago. Mm-hmm. So that really got it into the news.
Yeah. So now Tomich was sentenced in 2017. And yep. Lots of the hard facts in your piece were covered in reporting around the time of his sentencing. What did you feel was still left untold that made you want to write about it yourself?
So what's really intriguing about this story is Tomich is this master cat burglar. I mean, in the kind of old scheme of things, he's an expert climber. He's also an art enthusiast. He actually wanted to be a painter. He kind of sees himself as a high culture guy. He steals these paintings on a commission, and he's commissioned to steal just one, a Leger, and he has a buyer. And then, by the way, selling stolen art is really difficult. So the fact that he had a buyer that was going to kind of, you know, ferry it onto the black market made it a really kind of safer prospect for him.
Yeah,
the
and you know what? Let's stop on that point for a second, Jake. Yeah. It's so hard to resell stolen art. I would imagine partly because people would look at it and say, hey, that's a Matisse. How did you get your hands on this? What are some of the difficulties around reselling art that's been stolen?
Yeah, that's right. Like jewels, from a thief's perspective, jewels are way better. You can recut them, or even antiquities, because they don't have that singular identity as a piece of art. So you're talking about, keeping it in a room with no windows that just you're going to value. You can't resell it. So they say that, you know, the black market value of a piece of art is maybe 10% of what it would be worth if it was at Sotheby's or Christie's.
Wow.
So what he does, what Tomich does that really messes things up is he gets into the museum, right, which he does by removing this window. He painstakingly disassembles it over 6 days. He figures out how to get in around the motion detectors, which weren't perfectly working. He gets his painting. He's good. And which is the Leger, and then he turns and sees this Modigliani, and he just basically falls in love with it. And then he turns again and sees a Matisse. And by the time he kind of regains his senses, he's got five paintings in his bag, and he's out the window. And what happens is those five paintings missing bring such heat that the buyer panics. And what happens is, supposedly, is his accomplice, he's got two accomplices, claims that in the heat of the police apprehending him, that he destroys the paintings. Mm. But many people, including myself, were kind of like, yeah, right. What happened to them? So I wrote Tomich a letter in prison just to see, like, if he would be willing to sit for an interview if I went to Paris. And he immediately wrote me back and said, yes, I would, you know, I'm happy to talk with you about whatever you want.
Hold on, Jake, what does that letter look like? How do you open a letter like that? And how did you convince him to talk to you?
Well, I was kind of a shot in the dark. My editor at The New Yorker said, why don't you write him and see if he'll talk to you? And I was very, like, doubtful, but we had to find out what prison he was in. So I wrote this letter, and I wrote it in English because my French is not very good. And I had a translator who worked with me translate it into French. And then we get this kind of very detailed cursive French letter written back that not only says, yes, I'll talk to you, but immediately starts telling the story of why he took these particular paintings and how he loves art. And I thought, wow, okay, this guy is a talker. But the funny thing is that the request that I submitted to the French prison system to interview him dragged on for over a year and was finally rejected, actually. They said, no, you can't talk to him. But in the meantime, I just kept on writing him letters because I was thinking to myself, well, I'll get all the background information out of the way in this written correspondence, and then I can just zone. But that was all there ever was. But at some point, about a year in, I realized that this written correspondence was kind of awesome. And he would keep on hinting at the fact that he might know where the paintings really were, that they might not be destroyed, that maybe they're somewhere actually quite safe, and that when they're finally found, they'll return to the person to whom they truly belong, which he believes is him. And so we had this strange thing where he was playing kind of cat and mouse in these letters. And it was unclear to me, like, is he for real? Does he really know where these are? Or is he kind of just reveling in this mystery that he's created? Because there's a kind of a performance art aspect to this guy.
Sure. I mean, it sounds like he sounds incredibly interesting, but also a little bit hard to parse. And it sounds like from what you've learned through these letters with him is that from a young age, he was very interested in art. He had a good eye for it, even though he didn't have really any formal art education. Can you tell us a little bit about how he describes his relationship to art and why it is that he feels I don't know if entitled is the right word, but yeah. entitled, I suppose, to sneak his way into a gallery and now claim ownership of the things he's stolen.
Yeah, so he's got a funny relationship with art because he goes to a museum in Paris when he's about 14 years old. He wanders in off the street. And by the way, he's a Bosnian immigrant from a poor family, a family where it's pretty dysfunctional. The father's very rough on him. And he doesn't have a great experience in school. So he wanders into this museum, right? And he looks at the Monets and he appreciates them, but then he sees the Renoirs and he falls in love with the way that Renoir depicts childhood, a very kind of idealized, warm child smuggling with mothers, kids playing, and kind of just feels like this is the magic of childhood that I didn't have, and becomes obsessed with Renoir and comes home and tells his mother, I'm going to become a painter. I'm going to be like Renoir. And the father scoffs at it and says, you're going to become a car mechanic like me. And it's fairly brutal towards him. Mm. And so he says he abandons the dream of becoming a painter, but then he becomes a thief. And years later, he has his first chance to steal a painting. And somehow along the way in his head, stealing the painting becomes a substitute for actually creating it. And he doesn't like to steal paintings, so he says they're hard to resell. So he actually stole a number of masterpieces that he just held on to in his apartment. And I did say to him at one point, I said, in the letter, I said, why not become a museum guard? Like, we all love paintings. Why do you have to? And I asked his girlfriend this too. And the girlfriend actually gave me, I think, a more candid answer. And she said that he has like major impulse control. He's like a child. He sees, he wants, he takes. And he's very charming in the letters, but there's also a remorselessness about him that makes it makes at times a kind of darker and more frightening kind of portrayal of him, where you wonder, is this an amoral person that he can kind of so easily justify doing this? I mean, he's very enigmatic, and there's many sides to him in the letters, and I'm constantly grappling with kind of who he is and how I feel about him.
Well, it sort of seems like Parisians decided how they felt about him. I mean, he became sort of a hero in France for the robbery. Like, he was literally called Superman, especially because he was able to scale the building, right?
Yeah, and people, the museum had a faulty alarm system, and people thought, there was a sentiment that, like, oh, the museum kind of messed up. You can't hold this guy accountable. He became a darling in a kind of odd way, even though, you know, you can make this very strong argument that he stole from all of us. He stole this, this kind of great artistic treasure, and in a way we're all the victims of it. But that's not at all the way that he was received, for the most part, by the French public, where he was very witty in court, he was very polite with the judges, he was kind of had good comic timing, and he just became a kind of media darling.
So now he's serving 8 years in prison, and you've been in touch with him through these letters, and you said that he's hinted to you that he believes that these stolen paintings do exist, that they were not destroyed by one of his contacts. What more do people know now about where these paintings are?
It was funny. I was actually wondering whether the French authorities were monitoring our written correspondence, because I'm sure that they've got to watch him when he's released from prison to see what he does. I mean, he was careful in the letters, but he would say things like, there's no better place than where I've put them. And then another letter, he would kind of contradict it and say, I don't know where they are. The watchmaker, who was his accomplice, he knows where they are and he'll give them back to me. So he would be a little bit unclear or deliberately vague or misleading about where they might be, but there's no part of him that thinks that these paintings are destroyed. And he made that very clear. I mean, the prosecutor said to me when I interviewed the prosecutor was very clear about it. She said, these paintings, I have no doubt that they're not destroyed and that Tomic and his accomplices will be able to go and get them the minute that they're released.
So are you expecting that there will be a future chapter of the story to write for you? Are you still in touch with Tomic?
Yeah, I mean, I'm curious. It's going to be another 6 years of prison, so it's not going to have a tidy conclusion. But I definitely feel like I'm going to check back in with him as it gets closer and see if he's any more forthcoming about where these paintings might be. I mean, I think he's got a problem because his everyone's watching him so closely when he gets out, I think it's going to be very, very difficult for him to do much with them. But nonetheless, maybe they're out there stashed away, you know, buried in a field in a watertight bag.
Man, I hope we read that headline one day. And I hope it's your headline, Jake. Thank you for coming on. Jake Halpern is a contributing writer to The New Yorker, and he's the author of The French Burglar Who Pulled Off His Generation's Biggest Art Heist, which can be read in The New Yorker's January 14th edition. Stay with us.